You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about today's House Judiciary Committee hearing in the impeachment inquiry. Paul Nolet stays with us, political scientist at Marquette University. You can join in still with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 on what you saw today, what you hope is coming up next, or your questions. Peter joins us next in Viroqua. Peter, thanks for hanging on the line through the news there.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm wondering if someone's words can be considered facts. So we had recordings played earlier, both Nixon and Trump, and Trump's was eerily similar to Nixon's. So from the president's own words, we can make some conclusions. And without getting into that, I just want to know if someone's own words, like the president's, can be used as facts, because it seems like there seems to be this controversy over whether there's enough facts or not.
Peter, thanks a lot for the call. And yeah, Republicans today, as Peter was saying, challenging the idea that there were facts backing up Democratic accusations here. What do you think of Peter's question about the role of the president's own public statements?
Yeah, and in fact, I think it plays an absolutely crucial role, because I think one could argue that even after all of these hearings by now the Judiciary Committee and the Intelligence Committee before that and a number of witnesses, that still the most important piece of evidence was the rough transcript, that the president himself released of the conversation with President Zelensky about, potentially doing the president a favor. And seemingly linking it with the aid to Ukraine, and I think those words are ultimately still the centerpiece of the case here against President Trump. And so, in terms of do the words matter? Absolutely. I think there's a big difference in terms of how both sides interpret those words and how serious they are. But absolutely, the president's words are central to the entire discussion.
Thanks for that call, Peter, at 800-642-1234. Well, now that we've got some distance from it, I want to listen back to a couple moments from today's testimony. First, I want to listen to Professor John Turley talking about the importance of a proven criminal act in the impeachment process. Here's a listen.
You can't accuse a president of bribery. And then when some of us note that the Supreme Court has rejected your type of boundless interpretation, say, well, it's just impeachment. We really don't have to prove the elements. That's a favorite mantra that is sort of close enough for jazz. Well, this isn't improvisational jazz.
And that's a really important question here, Paul. If we're saying, okay, the president was pressuring Ukraine for a thing of value, in this case, announcing investigations, does it need to meet federal statutes for bribery that would have to hold up before a court? Or is there some different standard we could be held to in an impeachment hearing?
Yeah, and it is a very interesting question. And this, not surprisingly, has divided the parties as well. But it is sort of an open question about whether bribery, which again is one of the crimes actually mentioned in the Constitution along with treason and then high crimes and misdemeanors, whether that actually maps onto the meaning of bribery as set forth by Congress or the states. And so the argument against that is to say, well, a statute can be changed at any time. So Congress can change the definition, the elements of bribery, and states can do the same on the state level. But, the Constitution had this word bribery in it, so it should be a meaning that, has stayed constant throughout the years. At least that's one of the arguments here. And so I think from Democrats' perspective, they're saying, look, bribery is part of this. We don't need to strictly follow a congressional statute, since it's a different meaning of bribery when we're talking about that word in the Constitution, and especially when you link it to other articles of impeachment, which they would likely do, including abuse of power. I think the overall argument is, hey, you have to look at this holistically and look at the various ways that President Trump, abused his power, went beyond what a president should do. So from the Democrats' perspective, certainly they say, look, we don't need to follow that same statutory definition of bribery. We're moving forward with our view under the Constitution of what that what that means.
That was Jonathan Turley we heard from in that that quote there. He was the law scholar invited by Republicans. I want to give a listen now to Professor Pamela Karlan in her opening statement talking about the role of elections versus impeachment.
The framers of our Constitution realized that elections alone could not guarantee that the United States would remain republic. One of the key reasons for including the impeachment power was a risk that unscrupulous officials might try to rig the election process.
And that's another moment that gets to the heart of one of the key discussions here. One criticism from Republicans is, hey, the president won an election under our electoral college system in 2016. Voters will have a chance to weigh in on what he did or didn't do in 2020. Why bother with impeachment in the interim?
Yeah, and this goes back, I think, to that big picture about, you know, criticizing the process here. And it also gets to one of the reasons why I think there is some, ultimately, some speed on the part of Democrats. Because if this does drag on too far into 2020, you know, particularly on the House side, you know, it goes into January, it goes into February, perhaps even before it gets to the Senate, then I think they're going to face that criticism more and more to say, look, we're going to have an election just in a few months. Why don't we just resolve it then? So I think Democrats, from their perspective, they wanted to get this done quicker to block that criticism to some extent. But I do think, you know, Pam Karlan herself, she brings up an important point, which is to say, you know, we do have elections, sure, but there also is this process of ensuring that the president is not above the law. So the impeachment process is in the Constitution, separate from elections and separate from, you know, the presidential terms, in order to ensure that there's some sort of process to check and balance the executive branch when they might be abusing their power or going beyond what a president should do. So I think that does get to a lot of the crux of the process debate that's going on right now.
And in that quote from Karlan, was the issue a lot of Democrats brought up? Okay, a president could do bad things, and maybe we could leave it up to the voters in that instance. But the accusations, the allegations here are that this particular president was doing things aimed at influencing those elections themselves. Does that change the discussion a little bit, that election interference is on the table, and that might raise the stakes for impeachment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's another point in the favor of saying, hey, we should look at impeachment separately from elections. And that, you know, it's important to ensure the integrity of elections and to ensure that there isn't foreign interference. And so from the House side, you know, there has been this lengthy, even before the official impeachment inquiry, a lengthy process of gathering facts and trying to figure out what actually happened here and what Russia's involvement in all of this is, and, you know, perhaps the administration and those sorts of questions, I think, are important. So I would agree that there is a layer that's a little bit different than another type of impeachment inquiry, let's say, that didn't involve elections. I think that angle does in some ways raise the stakes and perhaps raise the difference between this impeachment process and, you know, the 2020 elections.
Paul, thanks for joining us and for being on call through this unpredictable hearing today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. He joined us for a look at today's hearing in front of the House Judiciary Committee on the constitutional grounds for impeachment. This conversation will keep going on in the days and weeks to come. You can still share your thoughts for now. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, does adversity make us stronger? Maybe, maybe not. A psychologist tells us what he's found in trying to research a hard-to-research question. First, for an inmate leaving prison, getting a job can make the difference between success and ending up back in the system. For women at Tichita Correctional Institution in the Fond du Lac area, they've got a new program for developing some key job skills, including a certificate in welding. That program launched earlier this year with some assistance from Moraine Park Technical College and the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Rachel Frida-Gady joins us. She's a social worker at Tichita. Rachel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about what's involved in this welding program this year at Tichita, what the inmates are learning and how they're able to practice the trade?
Sure. So this is our first time doing this program. The ladies, we have about 8 participating in each cohort. So they're really learning a lot of skills that kind of trains them for an entry-level welding position. So that way that when they get out in the community, they can, you know, have the criteria met just to be to walk into a job and say, you know, I've got a certificate, I know the skills, I know the machinery, you know, can I have a job? So it's really something concrete that they can walk away with from while they're here.
And to paint a little picture here, this is kind of cool. It's this mobile welding lab that can go for now into Cheetah. It might be at another prison in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So how does... they have a CNC program at one of our other sites, too. So that's proven to be really successful. So I know we're really hoping that the kind of the same thing can come of this program.
And what kind of response are you getting from the inmates who are going through this welding program?
They're very excited. I know there is definitely a waiting list for this program. You know, it's something different. And I think that for women, there's such opportunity for them to get into these kind of fields. It's not something that, you know, they've always thought that they could do. So now seeing this opportunity here for them, they're really excited. Especially after hearing, like, from some of the other successes we've had with our other programs, like the CNC program, they're really excited for the opportunities that they can get when they get out of here.
And then this is a partnership, right, with one of the technical colleges in our system?
Yep, correct.
Which one is working on that?
This Marine Park Technical College here in Fond du Lac.
In addition to this welding program and that CNC program you mentioned, there is, I understand, a new job center there as well. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. So this has been really exciting. I'm actually going to be going there later this afternoon to work with some of the ladies. So we partnered with the DWD. They even have said that our job center here is nicer than some of the job centers they actually work out of. So you walk in and it really just looks just like a job center. You know, it's got the logo. We've got all the computers. Everything's brand new in there. So what the ladies do is they come kind of in groups, depending on when they're going to be releasing. They kind of get oriented with using the computer, using the software, getting set up with an account on the Job Center website. And then depending on kind of what their needs are, it depends on where they'll go with that. You know, it might be they need help with resume building. They might need help identifying, like, what kind of skills might I be able to match with a job when I get out. Some of them need some help with, like, soft skills, job interviewing, things like that.
And you mentioned the Department of Workforce Development, the DWD, and I guess their interest in this in part is there's a shortage in some places in the state and some jobs of workers. Is that part of the goal here to help meet the state's labor needs?
Yes, absolutely. You know, having ex offenders is a really good labor source for a lot of people. You know, there's so many jobs open up, and this is just a really untapped population that finally people are starting to realize that could have a lot of potential and do a lot of good for us. You know, give them something positive and meaningful to go back to, help them make connections with people in the community that would be positive for them, and give them a purpose. So,
talking to Rachel Friday-Gady from Tichita Correctional Institution, social worker there, talking about job programs at the institution, including a job center and a welding program there right now. And Rachel, I want to follow up on that last point you made. Mm-hmm. How important is it, assuming we want inmates not to show up back at Tichita in the future, how important is it to get them on the path to a job?
Well, you know, a stable job not only provides them a source of income when they get out, but again, it gives them a constructive use of their time. Something that I hear pretty frequently from our ladies is that, you know, they get out, they don't have anything to do, they get bored. They start thinking about things that maybe they shouldn't be thinking about. They get involved with the wrong people, and then here we are again. So not only does it give them, you know, stability and income, it also gives them, you know, something positive, pro-social ties to other people in the community. It gives them so much opportunity.
And while they're still incarcerated, does it help to have this kind of goal that they're working toward along the way?
Yeah, absolutely. Research actually says that, you know, connecting our offenders with programs prior to release helps them build that relationship, and then they're more likely to maintain that relationship when they are released. So, you know, it helps them put a face with a name. So some of these DWD staff that are actually here will be working with some of these ladies upon their release into the community. So, and if not, they're going to be, you know, working with people at other DWD sites to kind of connect them ahead of time. So they're not just going in there and not sure about things.
Now, without these kind of programs, job training programs, what are the obstacles for someone leaving prison finding a job?
It can be difficult. I mean, there is definitely still some stigma around, you know, having a conviction on your record. And I think, too, what I hear a lot is that these ladies, they don't really know what kind of skills they have, so they don't know where to start. They don't have any guidance. They kind of just get lost in the shuffle with things, and then and they're kind of stuck. They end up doing lots of jobs, lots of odd jobs, things that they don't necessarily want to do just to try to get by. And, you know, they're not getting any real, you know, pleasure or gains out of it. It's just kind of a, here's a job, I go to work, I go 9 to 5. You know, it's not something that makes them happy. Having these opportunities to kind of find something that fits what they want to do, what they enjoy doing, what they already know, and then also providing that education, you know, through our vocational programs also gives them something concrete to walk out of here with.
As we wrap up, Rachel, we've talked about some applied programs like a welding, about the job center. What's next? What's down the road at Tichita when it comes to workforce training for the residents, the inmates there?
I know that we are going to try to partner with some staffing agencies, too, to try to do some, like, little resource fairs and mock job interviews, different things like that. I know that's something that the ladies have been asking for is they want to practice. You know, what do I say? How do I say it? How do I talk about having a record? That's something that they've maybe never had to have a conversation for.
Rachel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's Rachel Frida-Gady, social worker at Tichita Correctional Institution. We talked to her today about a new welding training program for inmates at the women's prison. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, failure, adversity, trauma, they're things we mostly try to avoid in life. Though we also like to remind ourselves that if and when we experience them, we'll come out the other side, hopefully as better people, wiser, stronger, with more appreciation of life. Is there data, though, to support that conventional wisdom? Our next guest has been studying that question. Aranda Jayawakrema is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Wake Forest University. He co-wrote a piece about growing from adversity on the website The Conversation. Aranda, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We'll get into some of your research and some of the difficulties of doing this kind of research in just a bit, but why did you want to tackle this problem of whether adversity and maybe even trauma can make us stronger, as is the popular idea?
No, that's a great question. So personally, I first got interested in this question of whether adversity could make you stronger when I was a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania. And I was doing my dissertation looking at survivors of the Sri Lankan Civil War. So there's a long-standing civil war in the north and east of the country that ended around 2009. And part of my dissertation research involved working with displaced populations there, looking at their mental health. And I was interested in looking not only at how they're struggling with, you know, significant psychological problems, but to what extent were people resilient in the face of a type of chronic stresses that they experience in Sri Lanka. So I started looking at the literature and came across work on post-traumatic growth, this idea that stressful life events, traumatic life events can sometimes lead to positive psychological changes. And I thought this was very interesting. It resonated with some of my intuitions of how sometimes stressful life events can make you learn things about yourself, can build personal strength. But then as I spent more and more time with the literature, I realized that there are actually some interesting ways in which they're measuring post-traumatic growth. They may not be the most methodological, rigorous assessments. And then that led to my current research program, trying to evaluate the methodological limitations of this work.
It seems difficult because you ideally you'd want a before and after for a bunch of people before trauma, I guess some without trauma, and be able to have that kind of apples to apples comparison. And of course, that's not how the world works. We don't go around measuring people in those ways or knowing who necessarily is going to experience trauma.
No, that's true. So I think, you know, and to give credit to the early researchers, I think, you know, a lot of the work that was done on post-traumatic growth was done with the, you know, based on the limitation that it is hard to collect data prospectively. So collect data before and after a traumatic event. It can be done. So there are researchers who will track large numbers of people over a period of time with the assumption or understanding that a certain proportion of those people will experience a significant adverse or stressful or traumatic life event. But these studies are expensive. Another issue is that typically, you wouldn't expect people to exhibit changes in response to an adverse event soon after the event. So if you want to look for evidence of post-traumatic growth, ideally, you should be tracking people for 1, 2, 3 years. And unfortunately, the vast majority of prospective studies, so these are studies that have been well-designed, don't go for maybe more than 1 year post-trauma. So I think, you know, doing this work is hard, in part because you need large samples, but also you need to track people for long enough after the event before you know whether people have changed.
As you study people and try to overcome these obstacles, what are you learning? What are you learning about how people come out of these traumas and whether they grow, however we want to define that, and how they suffer?
That's a good question. So I think there are a couple of things. First of all, I think our understanding of the types of life events that can lead to personal growth probably needs to expand a little bit. So much of the early work in post-traumatic growth was done with the understanding that it was trauma or traumatic life events that led to personal growth. And I think the intuition behind this was that there's something impactful about a traumatic event that would lead to changes in your sense of meaning, how you make sense of the world, and reconciling the discrepancy between your pre-existing worldview and the event allows you then to grow from the event. I think from the work that we have been doing, from work some of my colleagues in Germany and other countries have been doing, it's clear now that we need to be clearer about what characteristic of the event leads to personal change. So it might be that how impactful the event is what is critical, rather than whether the event is positive or negative. So to take one example, there is research showing that for certain dimensions, so for example, self-esteem or feeling that you have a sense of mastery over your environment, positive events seem to predict positive changes and not negative events. So I think we need to maybe reconsider our intuition that it's only trauma that can lead to personal growth. It might be some other characteristic that's doing the job.
Aranda Jayawakrema is with us, associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Wake Forest University. We're talking about his research on the impact of trauma and adverse experiences and whether we actually grow from those experiences, whether the idea that whatever doesn't kill us makes us stronger really works. Aranda, you've written that one concern you have that if we assume that, okay, a trauma, an adverse event is going to make us a better person down the road is what happens when somebody goes through that trauma and doesn't feel like they're growing? Are they going to feel like they're doing something wrong?
Yeah, no, I think that's a challenge. And I think it's especially a challenge when you live in a cultural context where there's an assumption that you're supposed to grow following a stressful life event, right? So, you know, this idea that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right? It's, you know, it's a quote from Nietzsche, the German philosopher, but it's also, you know, a lyric in popular songs, right? The Kelly Clarkson or Kanye West. And I do think when people talk about their traumatic experiences or their adverse experiences, they do talk about it in a way that acknowledges that they are supposed to learn something from it. So they always talk about a silver lining. Even if they're struggling in the wake of the event, they also will try and say something positive that's come out from it. So I do think there is a, you know, what some researchers have called a master narrative around how we should talk about a growth from adversity. In some cases, I think, especially for people who continue to struggle with the enduring impact of adversity, it can be an additional burden.
Is there a potential for using this as a tool if we see people using this narrative, maybe without thinking about it, of, you know, how can I grow from this trauma, from this adverse event? Is this something that can be used in therapy for someone to learn to tell and retell their stories in a way that actually helps them grow?
So Potentially, yes. So, you know, one project that I worked on with my colleague Anne-Marie Rupke and others is developing an intervention that tries to teach some of the skills around making sense or making meaning from the event, thinking about what your goals are, your values are in the wake of an adverse event, and then using those insights to try and grow from the event. So we did develop an intervention that we tested a few years ago, and we published our first set of findings last year, and the intervention showed some promise for reducing symptoms of depression in the short term. We did not find a positive impact of the intervention on post-traumatic growth. We think this is in part because of the size of our sample, because we had to keep participants in the study for more than a year, and we had, you know, attrition over the course of the year. But what we're doing now is that we're sort of reworking our intervention, adding some new modules, some new components, and our plan is to test it in a sample at some point next year. Now, I will say one of the challenges of these types of interventions, and this is something that we're very mindful of, is that it's important to be careful about when you introduce this idea, right, of meaning making or making sense of the event. Because if you don't do it at the appropriate time, it might be offensive to people, right? And mm-hmm. to go back to what we said earlier, you don't want people to feel like there's an obligation on expectation that they need to grow from the event. So I think we have to be careful about when we intervene. It's also true, and this is, you know, what I've learned from talking to counselors and social workers who worked with war-affected populations in Sri Lanka, having these additional tools as a counselor, when you work with people who have gone through, you know, pretty substantial trauma, can be helpful. Because I think at the right time, people do want to know, right, about not only how they can deal with, you know, their struggles, their suffering that resulted from the trauma, but also think about ways in which they can move on from it. And I think thinking about making sense of the event, potentially growing for the event, are very helpful tools that counselors can use as long as they're used at the right time.
I wonder, there's a wide range of things people might think of when they think of an adverse experience. It can be something that everybody deals with, you know, a bad breakup, a professional setback, all the way to, you know, surviving a terrorist attack, or as you say, people living in a war zone. Do similar lessons apply, or is, you know, a bad life moment different than something really traumatic like that?
That's a great question. So I think, you know, it's important to consider how different types of life events are going to impact you. Now, it's true that in part because a lot of early work on post-traumatic growth was done by clinical psychologists who were interested in the impact of clinical trauma, a lot of the early work was done on the assumption that it was only clinical trauma that could be a catalyst for personal growth. I think that's probably too restrictive. I think we do need to look at the types of events beyond clinical traumas that can impact you. I think one thing to think about is to what extent does the event change your subsequent environment? Because I think what might be happening is that for people who grow in the wake of adversity, it's because there's something about the event that's scaffolding your ability to perform different actions. So it may not be enough simply to look at a single event, but we also need to look at how that event changes how that person interacts with the environment subsequently. So just to give one example, there's some evidence that one way in which people do grow in the wake of adversity is in terms of social relationships. So multiple studies have shown that in the months and years following an adverse event, people do experience positive changes in the quality of personal relationships. And what might be happening there is that, especially if you've gone through some type of event that other people can relate to, so for example, if you're the victim of a natural disaster and you know other people have been through that, right? It's possible that you can, you know, commiserate on what's happened to you. You can express empathy for what the other person is going through. You have people who understand what you've been through. So there's something about the nature of that event and the presence of other people in the wake of that event that can help foster change.
Well, and that sounds like in our last few moments, at least one mm-hmm. take-home lesson maybe someone listening who's been through a traumatic event can have is to reach out, make those connections, especially when possible with someone who's been through something similar. Is that right?
No, th- That is completely correct. I think, I think we need to do a lot more research on to understand how trauma, adversity impacts our personality and can potentially lead to personal growth. But I do think, if there's one lesson that we can take away from the existing research is that, connecting with loved ones, finding people who you can talk to about the event, that's one way in which you can definitely, you can potentially recover and maybe even grow from the adverse experience.
Aranda, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Aranda Jayawardena is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Wake Forest University. We talked to him about his research into whether and how people can grow from adversity and trauma.